Morning, New Haven.
It's just us girls.
Good Friday. Happy Passover. And welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make the Elm City tick. Nothing ticks better than Punted Friday, which are about to begin here with the hardcore holiday crew in the WNHH studio with the number one pundits in the media universe. Norma Rodriguez Race is not here today. She's in church.
Yes. No church.
Amen.
Service. Amen.
Answering to a higher power. Hey, higher authority. Joe Ugly is not here. I am not going to vouch for where Joe Ugly is right now.
I know he ain't in nobody's church.
But we do have the team. We have pundits like Babs Rolls Ivy, the dairy-free goddess of our grassroots radio operation, the belle of our ball, the managing editor of the Inner City News, and host of WNHH's daily Love Babs Love Talks program. Welcome, Babs.
Hey, hey.
We have the flyest news hunter-gatherer this side of Fleet Street, boss of the Budget Beat and the Beauty Beat, Star New Haven independent reporter, Markeisha Ricks.
Happy Good Friday, everyone.
And we have the New Haven Independence News Desk's unstoppable and unflappable Lucy Gelman. Lucy, thanks for coming in today.
You're going to have to work on that intro.
I am. I'm sorry. But
no, you everybody wants to be fancy.
But Lucy, you don't have to get, Lucy has been working the controls. Harry Droz has the day off, too, the bravest man in New Haven. Lucy, I'm not hearing you that well. Is it that one mic that just doesn't pick up as well?
Yeah. So I'm kissing the mic, Paul.
Okay, and that's mic four, correct?
That's mic three.
This is mic three.
Okay, I'm putting mic three up at 11.
Testing.
But you know who else had his mic up to 11?
Uh-oh.
Two.
You know who else had his mic up to 11?
I know who.
A man who loves to have his mic up to 11 is John Lugo, the immigrant rights activist. And he had his mic up to 11 one day at a protest on Chapel Street outside Atticus Cafe, an immigrant rights protest under a dispute that's since been settled. Hooray. And the police arrested him.
Hooray.
And he's been arrested before on very specious First Amendment grounds. And this time when he got arrested, he decided, I'm not going to pay the $50 fine because I don't think I should have been arrested. And he had a lawyer who was willing not to charge him because you can't. And this is one of the catch-22s. If police arrest you for no good reason, you believe. If it's really wrong and they just said, I'm mad at you, I'm going to charge you with interfering or creating a disturbance, which are two charges I think they should ban the New Haven Police Department because they're misused so much just to say, I'm mad at you, I have no basis, I'm going to arrest you. And once you're arrested, it takes all this time to go to court or it can cost money for a fine that if the state says, well, we'll give you a nolly or just plead guilty, we'll give you some, you know, just pay the fine because it's going to cost you more to fight it. Or, you know, agree to the nolly because otherwise you're going to have to go to trial and pay a lawyer $1,000 and lose all this time. Here was a case where his lawyer, Patricia Kane, said, it's so important that police have to answer for what they've done that I'm going to represent him for free, pro bono, so he can fight it. So he went to court, and Markeisha was there on the second floor in the Elm Street courthouse. And it was an interesting day. It didn't end up with people saying, oh, I hate this cop, he's a liar. The cop went on the stand and he told the truth. The judge listened to everybody. And it was almost, Markeisha, from reading your story, like a seminar at a law school or something on our system.
It was so interesting.
It wasn't factory line justice.
It was almost as if everybody was kind of working together to learn something. Which, you know, and it had to be eye-opening for the police officer because he's a younger police officer. He hasn't been on the force quite 2 years. And, you know, he's getting hit with these questions that he probably wouldn't know the answer to. Like, did you know that there's a city noise ordinance and that you can test for it? Like, and usually when people file noise complaints, that's how you handle those. But I think, you know, you were mentioning earlier that about the misuse of certain kinds of, like, low penalty things.
Especially interfering.
Exactly.
Like,
and this wasn't the charge. This wasn't the charge for John Lugo. It was the charge of creating a public disturbance. And, you know, it could have been escalated to something else, but it's just a civil fine against state law, right? And, you know, this young cop, I don't think he was trying to misuse
What's
it.
What's his name?
His name is Anthony Magnano. And I think, you know, he's like, I feel responsible basically to respond, right? Like, you have the owner of the business upset, and at the same time, he's been properly taught that you don't want to escalate these situations, you don't want to put people in jail unnecessarily. So he's like, the best I can do is to ask these guys to pipe down. They don't have to leave, or as long as they're obeying the law in terms of not blocking the sidewalk or blocking the front of the, or like keeping people from going into the establishment. But at the end of the day, they are making a lot of noise, and so at the very least, I can give him a ticket. And so, you know, and John Lugo apparently rips up the ticket. He signs it, he accepts it, and then he rips it up, which could have escalated with the white cop. So he escalated into something else.
And that's a good point, because often in these situations, Lugo had a similar experience outside Goodfellas, where a diner said, "My wife doesn't like people out there protesting loudly." And then the police really were upset with Lugo's attitude and trumped up charges and escalated it. And we saw this in other cases too, like with our photographer, David Sepulveda, when he was arrested in Westville. And it seems like the cop did the opposite here. It seems like he was mature and secure enough that he said, "I'm going to cite him for something I think I should cite him for, but I'm not going to escalate it because I'm mad he ripped it up and gave me attitude." And yet there was also, so he was honest and on the stand he didn't lie about it, but there was still this point that is a protest a public disturbance, mm-hmm. or is it dangerous just because someone complained to give a ticket for that? And that was the interesting question that landed in our courthouse where so often, especially in Elm Street, that's factory line justice. You have people going in for 7 seconds or a minute at a time. Cases aren't really heard. The merits aren't really heard. Evidence is rarely produced. I mean, some cases, but I'd say less than 10% or 5%. And in this case, on a mere $50 ticket, we had a discussion really and a trial about whether we think this is a public disturbance to do a protest where you happen to have a loud megaphone. So what happened, Markeisha?
And so the judge, who's Judge William Wenzel, he's very thoughtful. And in addition to the attorneys being able to ask questions, and there are only three witnesses in the entire trial, he was very thoughtful about asking questions. The attorney for John Lugo was trying to make the case, Patricia Kane was trying to make the case that, you know, ultimately, this fine was violating John Lugo's First Amendment rights because his protest didn't turn threatening. He didn't threaten anyone who was going in and out, even though the point of the protest, and this was listed in the testimony, and John testified to this as well as another member of UNIDAD named Jose Morales Sanchez, that, you know, the point of the protest at that time was to get people to not shop at Atticus. But what the cop attested to is that, you know, while people were like uncomfortable or complaining, he's like, they didn't stop doing what they were doing. They kept eating at Atticus. They kept buying books. They were going about their business, and nobody had been literally harassed for going inside. But, you know, they could hear them, because if you think about Atticus's location, they have a whole glass front. So it's not hard to hear people,
right,
who are outside yelling, particularly with a megaphone. And John admits, he fully admits that, you know, we turn our megaphone up, A, because it's cheap. So like Radio Shack megaphone, $100. So it's cheap. It's not that loud in the first place. And then on top of that, like, they use megaphones. And Lucy and I can attest to this. We've been to plenty of protests where they use megaphones. And you're usually using them to shout to the people inside the building in front of whether it's City Hall or some business. But at the end of the day, they might be annoying you or harassing you, but you feel harassed because they're there. But if they're not like violent or physically trying to harm you, they're just protesting. They're exercising their First Amendment rights, and annoying speech is protected.
So what did the judge say in the end about this $50 fine?
So the judge actually wasn't swayed necessarily by Patricia Kane's argument or on the First Amendment grounds, or the content of the speech. Like, he wasn't worried about those. What he was worried about was what was unreasonable. And so there's this vague idea of that noise can be unreasonable, but like the court would have to decide what is unreasonable noise. And he didn't think that the state had proven its case that what John Lugo had done that day to earn him a $50 ticket was unreasonable.
And in the end, when they walk out, usually in these cases, people get upset. They feel the cops lied. The cops feel that they were put in a
bad
light.
Everybody left like feeling like, okay, that was justice.
I mean, the lawyer, Pat Kane, is very critical. He said this is a good cop and he was honest. This is a great judge.
Absolutely.
They heard me. He didn't agree about everything, but this was fair. This was justice. And so I say, now, what's the cop's name again? Mangano.
And I think Magnano.
Officer Magnano,
mm-hmm.
and Judge Wenzel,
mm-hmm.
Attorney Kane, John Lugo, our hats are off to you. You've made New Haven a better place, and you've held up the justice system to its highest ideals and lived them.
Absolutely.
And we're also going to use a megaphone to remind people that are listening to Pundit Friday and WNHH Radio, broadcast at 103.5 FM and live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're also looking at you here on Facebook Live. Thanks.
Yay.
For joining us on this Friday. So someone else who uses a megaphone a lot, or actually isn't using a megaphone, but I wish would, is the city health director, Byron Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe something happened. We reported this last Friday in The Independent. That is almost a crisis, a public health, public confidence crisis, which is that close to 600 people who have sexually transmitted diseases and some minors who have lead poisoning, their private medical files were hacked. A disgruntled ex-employee of the health department went past the security guard who had orders to say not to let her in the building. She goes upstairs, locks herself in the room with the help of a union steward. She's not even the union, she's a probation employee. And her intern locked the door. When people come looking for him, she shushes them and says, don't snitch, and they can't get in. And then she methodically eliminates from a Center for Disease Control's web-based platform, government database, the personal records of all these people's files.
Do we know why she did this?
We don't know why. So then what she did is she put in a thumb drive. And she started downloading a lot of files. And according to the police affidavit, because she was arrested for computer crimes, and that's actually a category.
Did she have like a boyfriend she was trying to take care of?
I don't know. But in any case, she also started downloading files, and the intern said they were right when she was asking her about and looking at these personal people's files. And she told the police, I didn't download that stuff. But then she also told the police a lot of stuff that ended up being blatantly untrue because they got video evidence and all this other kind of stuff. So they didn't have the hard and fast what she took with her. They are hard and fast because they got the FBI in and they recovered some files of what she eliminated. And the city then had to write a letter to people saying your stuff was tampered with. They claim they're going to improve security both online and at the building. But the city will not make Kennedy available to talk about it. I think this is a moment. We need to hear about the health director say that we're trying to keep your records safe. And here's how. They haven't said how. They're going to make things safer, improve things. They haven't said whether they've tried to find out what was on that thumb drive. This woman runs a camp. Did she somehow want to market to these kids, or was she going to do blackmail? We have no evidence of any of that. But, I mean, this is important stuff. There are federal laws about privacy here people have the right to. And there are such basic questions not answered. And if you can't answer them, then you need to come publicly and tell us that. I think this is a moment
when a public official... Well, didn't the union guy know that he wasn't supposed to be up there with her like that? What didn't she...
Well,
she was not allowed to go up there.
He knew she was saying, shush, don't let them in here, don't snitch. And they knew that she was carting out stuff on a thumb drive from a database. And do you remember when Mike Carter got in trouble, the city CAO, because at a disciplinary hearing,
he
yelled at the union steward? Mm-hmm. That's what this was about. This is about disciplining that union steward.
He should have got yelled at.
And the union is saying that they shouldn't discipline him.
Why? He was I'm sorry.
And they won't talk about that either. So, but here's
such
my case. Am I wrong about this, that the health director of a government, that this is the moment we need to see you and hear from you to reassure us or explain to us when
something... So why are they capping him?
They claim because it's an ongoing investigation. The police have told me there is no ongoing investigation. That's something that's always cited when you don't want to talk about something when there are charges, because technically
like,
you
no,
could
the police aren't involved. It's an internal investigation.
Yeah, so
who's doing it?
But whether or not there's an investigation, a public official can always come in public and say, well, here's what I can tell you, here's what I can't, and here's how I can reassure you. You wrote a letter to some people and write a press release. That's not the same thing.
I think you should always... on the side of transparency with people, particularly when it comes to their financial information and their health information. And this is an opportunity to get out in front of something that is a real concern to people. I thought people had a lot of really good, interesting, important comments in our comment section talking about, oh, wait, this is probably a violation of federal law because she's only charged with like misdemeanors.
Right. Because they couldn't prove certain parts. So
but what they can prove is she did take people's information.
We proved that she eliminated it from the database.
So we don't know
tampered
why.
With it.
We
right?
just think.
And I can't get. I've asked people privately. I'm not going to repeat the theories because we don't have basis for them. I have not been convinced yet on the why. I've asked people for different theories.
I mean, this just seems just like a weird sort of thing. Like
it seems bizarre. It seems bizarre that this is...
So the woman told the police the reason I did it was because my intern has access to my computer or she was going to steal the information. Now, the way it worked...
But again, as people pointed out, like, why does your intern have your password information?
Because
I know it was supposed to be some, like, they're working together and so...
Right,
but you provide her own... And why does an intern have access to, like,
because
private,
here's why.
Personal information?
Because the intern's job was to work with her on this database with private information. And the reason she didn't have her own computer and information was they didn't want it spread out. It was a security measure.
But yet so the person that she's working with is the one who is now accused of actually
right.
taking or eliminating
so
people's
that's what
information.
That's what I'm saying.
That's crazy.
That's what I'm saying. Her explanation didn't hold up because that was the rule. They set it up with her under her direction
but
to
I'm,
have this intern
what
work
I'm
on
that
computer.
What I'm saying is that's a bad rule. That you need checks and balances. And quite frankly, for people who do work in research, even if you're an intern, I think they have checks and balances that make so you can protect people's information.
Well, she was still working on that database. And the way they protected it was not to have it on too many computers with too many passwords. She had to go into the office because of the computer. Her supervisor was the woman who was fired. She's no longer working there. So the only person working on the database was that intern. So it was appropriate that, of course, she's going to continue working on that computer.
But when this woman was terminated, why didn't they change the passwords or give this intern since she's on the these are the protocols that need
I've left
any place I've ever left and I'm not a criminal and I've not stolen anything I can't get back into my old job. I can't just show up with my old passcode. I can't flash my old badge and be
work there
and that's crazy though.
See, that's the part that I think this is the part that for me is troublesome. If you fire some everywhere that I've been and I've been fired from places, they just walk you out. You can't go back and get stuff.
And they're like, we'll mail you your stuff or set it on the curb.
That's why they had the rule. She asked to come back and she specifically was told no.
Okay,
so we're going to leave your stuff at the desk. And she went by the guard and said, with the union steward, and said, oh, I have to get a plant. I need some stuff. I'll be on the third floor. And like, he
didn't
stop her.
So why didn't the security guard stop?
So that he didn't stop. And then he notified a superior and they started looking for her in the office.
I was about to say, didn't your story say they were looking for her? Didn't they know where her office was?
That's the thing. She said, I'm going to the third floor, but her office is on the ninth. So she had time to go into that office the ninth and lock it. Eventually, they did get to that office.
But they believed her when she said she was going to the third floor?
So then they eventually got someone who works with her in the office, an administrative assistant. So they eventually made it to the ninth floor. That's when they start knocking on her door because
she
was locked
her door and they don't have keys to her office.
I guess
doesn't make any sense.
That doesn't make sense.
That
either.
Doesn't make sense.
You know, there's so much here that doesn't make sense.
Not
and that's
a
why
thing.
I'm saying, why is the city? I think this is a huge failure.
I'm sorry, Paul
Bass.
There's no way I have keys to the office and you don't have keys to the. I don't understand.
So that's why I think it's a huge failure on the part of the Harp administration. Not that this incident occurred, but that when you're handling it. First of all, the letter didn't go out to the victims until January. The theft took place and the elimination in July, five months later.
What?
And then no one knew about it.
Is there any protocol for what happens when there's a breach of information? What is wrong with the department?
And then the public didn't know about it until we reported it last Friday.
Oh, Lord.
And then after we report it, they still will not make the health department available in public to be seen talking about and answering these basic questions. So in the absence of that, you have no faith in how your government runs. And in the protection, you have no reason to believe that privacy rights are being protected and people's information.
Well, they're not.
And it makes it's like what other things are being violated? Like, that's what I'm now concerned about because there's no way you can
secure this. If you can't secure this, like if you can't handle this and it takes so long, and this is public safety. So you mean to tell me all this information, people's information are floating out there and nobody is what? How does that happen? I'd be mad if, you know, I'd say
come out of your rocket, explain it.
Yeah,
or
that's what I say.
Remember that you're listening to Pundit Friday on WNHH, New Haven's community radio station at 103.5 FM and live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Well, someone who will have a megaphone for about another year and a half, a year and three quarters, will not have a megaphone come 2019.
Ooh.
Oh, Dan
a certain
Malloy?
Governor named Dan O.P. Malloy. He
why
announced
is he not
on
running?
Thursday
because well, everybody hates him.
He's been in for two terms.
Who cares?
First of all, I remember John Rowland, the governor, said
he doesn't want to be a rock on the Democratic ticket.
John Governor Rowland ran for a third 4-year term, and he won easily. And then when he was running against a guy named Bill Curry, a Democrat, Rowland was a Republican. Curry said, "Don't we elect this guy? He's going to go to jail, and here's why. There are all these no-bid contracts worth hundreds of million dollars to a company called Tommaso, and they're stealing it." And he said, ha, you're such a like a killjoy liberal. Roland's fun. And then within months of Roland getting reelected, the feds were in, and he was going to jail. And I remember he came to New Haven before this all collapsed, and he said, what was I thinking when I ran for a third term? Now, Dan Malloy has not been accused of stealing. He has been accused of having his campaign misuse campaign money, get money he wasn't supposed to get by circumventing a law. The feds cleared him on that, on the legal parts. I don't think that's not why he's not running, but I brought up that story to say, I don't know if it's a good idea to run for a third term as governor. I think that you could do a lot in 8 years, and then especially in the current political environment, you become toast. His popularity is so low now, and it was the only reason he won the second term. And this isn't a
like,
reflection.
Isn't it only
how
higher than like Chris Christie?
Yeah, so I mean,
it's
and
really
that's
bad.
Not necessarily a reflection if he's doing well or badly. But I'm just saying that your leverage is low. The only reason he won a second term, and I remember him saying this early in the term. Yeah, my numbers are low when he ran for reelection, but I'm going to make the Republican Foley look so bad come October, no one's going to vote for him. And he still just barely won.
Yeah.
Because he had such a weak candidate who was so easy tar and feather. He's not ready to do all that again. He's not going to win a third term. And then the way he spun it was, because he's done some brave stuff. I think Malloy has really got to learn to try to accomplish some stuff that's hard. The first term, he put in a record tax increase along with union givebacks. The only governor during that time of tight state budgets who did both rather than one or the other. That still wasn't enough because we have a hard time recovering from the recession. He also did some criminal justice reforms that were hard, that were needed.
And tried to push for more this year.
And he's trying to do some long-term financial changes that don't get you reelected, but do help the state go on a longer-term footing. He wants to do a big transportation overhaul in the state. I've still got my personal gripe about the bus system, but I think, you know, he has done a lot with trains and for rich people go to Fairfield County,
and so
New York.
Why don't people like him?
Why do you think?
Maybe it's because of those tough decisions and maybe he's had to step on.
And also, he's the one when Mike Pence is governor of Indiana, we're not taking the surrogate immigrant family. He said, come in here, New Haven.
Right, and he believed that, but that's what we want, though. We want a governor like that. Why would we want something
And he's
else?
Been good to New Haven, except for the buses. I mean, he supported this live, work, learn, play, even though even by his own estimation, they didn't have that together.
I just think people, we too much for reality show foolishness, I think.
I think he has a tough personality to sell.
Yeah,
he's a very talented, smart guy. He has sort of a early DeStefano administration manner of saying, I'm smarter than you and screw you. I'm going to do what I want. I'm more important. You know, it's like he has a way, even though I've always felt him easy to deal with and so have some other reporters because he's very substantive. If you want to talk about running things, doing stuff, how are you going to make the decision? He really knows what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. He's accessible and he's great on point. He has, you know, he's terrible with personal skills. I mean, I don't know if that matters or not.
I know, but so is a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean,
a
lot of people are not very good at interpersonal.
I mean, Donald Trump, I wouldn't want to like have dinner with that guy. Actually,
I don't even want him as my president.
So there's got to be other people. I mean, because
you don't go to
taxes.
Dinner to him, he might try to blow you up.
He's raised taxes more than any other governor. According to Ned Lamont,
know,
who would run against
him,
he felt he actually didn't raise them enough. He inherited such huge problems with the pensions that had those balloon payments that John Roland
that,
put in.
Paul, like he raised taxes as if somehow or other he's just got some personal vendetta against our state. No, this is the way we raise revenue in this state.
And he was trying to overcome historic structural deficits that are going bigger because we have a progressive income tax in our state where we, as we should, tax people more if they make more, especially if you're from kind of Gold Coast. And because of the vicissitudes of the financial markets, you make so much money one year and then so much on another that you report, you could actually, on the basis of a few years of what's happening in the markets, your whole state treasury can lose millions and millions of dollars just from a few taxpayers. That's been argued why we had these big and large expected deficits. We also just had a recession that we're coming out of that, but he did.
It just sounds like we need voter. We need
and do you see
education.
It as an opportunity, like where, you know, he's had to do some things that he's kind of steered the state through some pretty tough times, but like that he hasn't been a rallying point for the party here in this state, right? Because the folks in the legislature seem to feel like they got clobbered because the Democratic Party in the state didn't really have a message that countered what Republicans had, who had a very consistent
election.
Message in
but
the last election.
But the Democrats
election.
Don't have a message anywhere.
That's
like
true.
All across the
That's
country,
true.
Their message
but,
is, I but, don't know what it is.
But he's the de facto head of the party as the governor. So if he can't pull them together, like.
But no one could pull them together.
I thought he had a strong anti-Trump message. He was very pro-immigration, pro-transit and mass transit.
And I think that's fine as far as a national message. Mm-hmm. Like the state, I'm talking about the state party. Like they just didn't seem unified. And I feel like they kind of blame him for it. And that might not be accurate.
Well, he was very unpopular.
They
were right that he became the state Republican Party in the last election ran against Malloy. He wasn't on the ticket, obviously, because he never went for governor midterm election. But all the ads that these legislators won seats that flipped from Democrat to Republican had ads that had Dan Malloy's face. We hate Dan Malloy. But I also think in modern politics, you hate the incumbent the way half the country was learned to hate Obama and hate Obamacare, even while they loved what Obamacare was. I think we're in a culture where, and they did this to Bill Clinton, they did this to the second George Bush, they did this to Obama, they're doing this to Trump, and obviously I agree with it with Trump, but they're doing it to Trump too, where you demonize the president in a way that you're not really talking in this very shallow way about stuff that doesn't really have to do with policy often. Obviously we have a lot of disagreements with Trump about policy, very fundamental, but like what they did to George Bush too and what they did to Clinton Obama.
Why are incumbents so bad at though at being able, because Obama was kind of bad at this, which was really getting out the message, this is what we've done for you, and he's even admitted that very late that we were late getting our message out about the things that we had accomplished.
And I think he
should. And maybe Malloy's.
But I also think there's a hate machine with modern media and mass media. Mm-hmm. It's very personalized. It's funded by people with a lot of money at stake who don't want to admit what they're really putting the money up for, like the Koch brothers, which is that government let them pollute as much as they want, steal as much money, take as much money, and take advantage of workers. But they're never going to call it that. They're going to say, we hate Obama because he's a black guy. But we won't use those words, right? Or that he's going to impress you by letting you have health care. Which is so un-American. And I think that every incumbent's got it. I don't like it. Like, I think I didn't at all approve of the second George Bush's policy. But I think he was demonized in a way that was very counterproductive. Mm. And the same with Bill Clinton. And it was all noise. It wasn't about how we run our country. I don't know. Any thoughts about that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it has gotten progressively worse.
And we're responsible in the media. I think we are responsible as the media.
I think we have to take a whole lot of that, because this information can't get out unless we put it out. And we get to sort of tear it down if we choose to. We can go against the grain and say, no, we're not going to focus on that. We're going to focus on this, and we're going to stay on message.
But then we have to put it in a way that's interesting to read. We have to care about it, make it interesting.
But it's beyond interesting now, see, because now it has to have entertainment value.
That's what I mean. So how do you do that? You read the Connecticut Mirror, which has such smart, great stories. And I don't even read it as much as I should. And we always use that word should, but people seem to feel like they should be reading this like they want to. So when they read about the inherent problems in the pension plan, how difficult it is to dig out of some of our debts we've inherited, and how the options are all imperfect, how many people are going to read that?
That's an interesting question because I think there are people who read for the, and we probably all do it to a certain extent. We read for the things that reinforce what we already believe.
Yes.
So instead of, but you can read something like the Connecticut Mirror and just read it for information.
Well, like the way we do zoning. Yeah. Like you and Lucy and I and the others, we get so excited to learn about, like, I got so excited to learn when you're moving a freezer, you want to put a planter up so you can build a building, that there's rules about how we want our streets to look.
And
that
it turns,
and it's
rules.
Complicated. We actually get instant the fact that you learn that if you can put a big freezer somewhere outside or a planter, that's actually called a structure like a building. And therefore, you got to change the rules so you can put it there if it's too close to another yard or the street. And that in order to do that, we want to do that so that we can have a neighborhood that has stores and buildings on it. When we think about that level, our readers do respond. People do, the same people who would rather read Obama's nice or bad rather than, you know, the Affordable Care Act is helping this number of people get insurance, or I hate Malloy raised my taxes versus we inherit this big pension problem that every state has. Here are the four options. They're imperfect. These are three ways we can go. I'm finding at local level you can do that if we care about and don't think of that we're serving a broccoli. There's this broccoli journalism argument that says, you know, the good responsible news organizations serve you your broccoli that you don't want to eat, so you learn about what you need to know. No one's going to read that. Well, I love broccoli, but I say give them broccoli Rob journalism. Maybe a little garlic.
A little garlic, a little pepper, a little lemon.
But it is the broccoli. It's not cheap. It's the real stuff.
But see, that's the problem.
But we're working hard.
So basically, it's like when you give your dog medicine, you put it in a cube of cheese.
Yeah, but cheese rather than sugar.
I hear what you're saying. The problem I have with this whole thing is that, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to sugarcoat things, and we don't like the truth.
I don't want
to
sugarcoat. I want it the truth. I want it to be substantive. I want it to be broccoli Rob, which is just as good as broccoli. It just took me a little more time to cook it because it's going to taste better.
Well, then,
but it's 100% nutritious.
Then I want Idris Elba to deliver the news. How about that?
Well, we're going to serve them up in any
t-shirt.
Case. We're serving them up in
no
any case.
No t-shirt.
Oh, yeah, no t-shirt.
But on the menu is Pundit Friday. And that's what you're listening to on WNHH New Haven's home for community radio at 103.5 FM, Lodge deemed at newhavenindependent.org. You know, one thing we don't read about much in New Haven, but it's been a real fact of life for thousands of families, is housing cooperatives. So in the 70s, for the most part, in some cases the 60s, we built all these housing cooperatives in New Haven with the help of federal money or federally insured loans, mortgages, kind of loan, all over town, where people, the tenants get the mortgage, they set it up. It's working families, low-income families. They run their own community through a co-op, and in the end, they own the place. And it worked well for a long time. And then they all got in trouble. They fought on their tenant councils. People moved out. They didn't invest enough, put enough money to hold it up. And we saw a lot of them fall apart, a lot in Dwight, like Ethan Gardens, the old Dwight co-ops, the Union Trade Union Plaza, and private developers got them. And they became private because they'd run down. And the sad part was Dwight co-ops, after something like 25 or 30 years, they were one payment away from owning the joint. The place had fallen apart. They weren't getting along. And then the city brought in a developer, couldn't do it. But then they found someone who could under the Harvard administration. It worked out. But there are a couple that survived. Florence Virtue Apartments in Dixwell They were refinanced, and the tenants are running it, and it's good. I think it's called Friendship, right over here in behind the fire station on Artisan, on Worcester Square. Mm-hmm. But in the last couple of weeks, we've had stories about two that are in limbo. So Antillian Manor, which is in Dwight near Chapel and Day, no one even there remembers that it's a co-op. There are only two people who were there from the original place. They don't know because it hasn't met for years. No one could find the co-op owners. So at HUD, the Federal Housing Urban Development, which pays the rents there through Section 8, they asked the company, Carabetta, that does Bella Vista, to come run it. So Cara said, we're not going to make money in this, but maybe we'll get this value real estate and run it ourselves. So they tried. They weren't running it well. And the city almost had to close it down as a danger to people being alive because the second floor balconies are falling apart and little kids are running on them and stuff. And then they had emergency repairs, but they said, maybe we can buy it. They tried to get the tenants to say, just sign us that we really own the joint. And they didn't do
members.
That.
Members. Yeah. The members.
Not, you're right, members, not tenants. But they don't know they're members. They don't even exist. They see themselves tenants, but Lucy's right. They're technically not tenants.
So
now they are going to buy it. Now they have a plan to buy it and tear it down and build a new place. And the tenants at this point say, fine, you know, we're just tired of the thing, and they're getting rewarded. But Lucy wrote about a more complicated complex that I never even knew exist, I'm embarrassed to say. I knew about all these other co-ops, and we always heard about all these other co-ops. But there's a place with 72 apartments called Hill Central
Community Cooperative.
It's near Hill Central School. It's back behind the fire, across from the fire station.
Oh, yeah, I know where that
behind
is.
Behind
the little school. Brick places. They look brick.
They're not brick.
Oh,
so they're homes that
you're thinking of Ann Boyd's place by Washington Avenue.
They're around if you so like
that's what I thought they were too.
Portsea Street, DeWitt, Howard.
It's its own
Washington
little its own little
Avenue.
World back there that's cut off from a lot of cut streets behind Clemente School, right off Howard Avenue, across from the fire station where Hill Central School
is.
So I guess we didn't even know it was there, and this did not run down. This place has a mortgage left, but it's not huge, and it's valuable real estate. It needs an upgrade. But it's not going to be demolished. But they, too, had a private – they stopped having their tenants associated. It exists. But for a lot of years, they filed no reports. It was kind of going not really that functional. And another private management company came in getting Section 8 rents from HUD. And they, too, are now wanting to buy the place. They're actually going to pay some real money to the tenants, like over $3 million. But what's so weird is that it's hard to know – not tenants, members. It's hard to know – thank you, Lucy – she corrected me that 10 times when I was editing the story.
A member's question.
Yeah, so the head of the – but the member doesn't even live there. It was the head of the tenant association. The management association
handles
all the
mail. So that's what I was
going
to ask.
So
they can have tenants that are just Section 8 and members who used to live there are confused.
They're all members. So it's still a functioning cooperative, although there's a question of whether or not people actually remember that.
Okay.
And even members who I talk to think of themselves as tenants, but technically they're not tenants. And that's based on the equity ownership model of cooperative
cooperatives,
housing.
Yes.
Yep.
I took a real estate class.
Because we hear about New York City and the wealthy buildings where people are co-op owners. Okay. Even New Haven, where on York Street, the you know, those three projects in a row, they're like Crown Towers, University Towers. Mm-hmm. University Towers is a co-op. But when it comes to working families, New Haven, a lot of these have fallen apart. Mm-hmm. Here, it did not yet fall apart. But now this company wants to buy it and invest the money to make them better and pay off the tenants one time, or not, the members one time, and have them officially be tenants now like they think they are. I just had some suspicions about this. There are really two sides to it. Because like one city official said to me, I think this is great. They owned it for 30 years. And is that right, Lucy? 30
years? More than almost 40
years. They owned it for almost 40 years.
Wow.
They controlled the place. And now they're going to make some money selling it. But then the lawyer who's still down as though he were still the agent for it in state records has had nothing to do with it for 20 years. He said, people there, we never really worked on these to help people understand what it meant to be the owners rather than tenants. And in fact, it wasn't made so that the whole place would be sold to some developer, make a lot of money, you get a one-time payment, and we no longer have cooperative housing. The whole point was that an individual can sell his or her share in his or her unit. But it's supposed to still be a co-op, and that we've gone so far in all these places, except for maybe Florence Virtue, of understanding what a co-op is, that he thinks this is not a good thing. And, you know, I look at it when I see that the person who runs the association, in fact, doesn't live there, but stands to make, you know, 50 grand or whatever from this deal. When I see that the management company is handling all the mail, which they maybe should because they do it day-to-day, but they're the only ones in knowing what's going on and treating people like tenants, people worried about getting evicted. when you see that the state records, they weren't filing reports, and they still have down as the address for the associations, the address the guy who's actually working for the management company.
This
wants
sounds
to buy
like it was
place.
A really good idea that was very badly executed.
But maybe it's pie in the sky to think these comps are going to work. Maybe these comps just don't work.
I mean, they
know.
Could work if people.
It sounds like it works for wealthy people.
Well, when you keep people ignorant in the dark, it's not going to work.
Or if people move a lot, like a lot of people are shy. Hard, fast for cash, although rich people like that too. They could be cheap too. Like at Dry Cops, they just never put in the money to keep the place up.
But I think if you...
they never charge themselves
enough. But it sounds like they didn't
fees.
Know.
Because they didn't know.
Yeah.
But if you know, if you educate people...
Like somebody should have almost come to them every year to
they
talk
had
to them about
that. That's right. Actually, they had factions. They just got so fed up with fighting, they just stopped.
Oh, they're like, it's over.
Now, you know, I don't mean to disagree with you at all, Babs.
No, no.
I'm actually
know
asking
not.
This question I'm about just, can it work?
It can't. Anything can work if you...
So this way,
if you have will, see, there's no will for this to work.
See, I love Lucy's story because it's a gray area story, and you can still read it. It's up there on the site. I mean, you really read it. I don't know about you, Lucy, after reporting. I know that I have all my suspicion bells going off, but at the root of it, after covering all these co-ops, I'm not sure whether there's an alternative or not.
No, I'm not entirely sure. I think this was a gray area story as the person who reported it, I really wish I could have gotten more information. And I will say the management didn't really want to talk to us, which of course is
gee,
something.
Well, I wonder why when they're getting a valuable piece of real estate and hoodwinking everybody who has no idea
what
they're really doing.
Stand to
boy, I would
lot
love to call
money
up the press and say, here's everything on the table we're up to. And why don't you scrutinize it before we make our quick money?
But I did. I mean, so I guess the big questions.
And
this
is like, I'm not even about this Got You Life. I'm just trying to understand more.
I'm just trying to understand more. And but I did wonder. So members still have it in like a membership agreement that there are four membership meetings a year. There are supposed to be four membership meetings a year. And all of the families who live in the complex can attend those meetings. So they're not public. They're just for people who live in the complex. And some of the families and members that I talked to said, well, we just don't go to the meetings. We, you know, we don't.
Which
we
is
don't
true
go
in life.
Yeah.
People usually have a core.
Yeah, but yeah, if they don't understand that they are members rather
exactly
than tenants, then they're going to act like tenants and think that somebody is managing something and that has nothing to do with them.
But so, if it's in fact not a real co-op anymore, when these management companies come in, you feel like your tenant might get evicted. You don't really understand it. If I were they, I might say, okay, I'll take the $50,000.
But this was also a question that I had because I talked to a couple members who had grown up in the complex, whose parents had moved into the complex in the late 1970s, who said, you know, I remember when I was growing up that people would hand a flyer to my mom every 3 months or every 4 months saying that there was a meeting. They would walk around, they would kind of give literature out to members in the complex, and that doesn't happen anymore. So I think, again, we're getting at the fact that members may not actually know their members, and folks who moved in more recently, you know, there are people who have been there for 3-4
and so that rings my manner, suspicion they, bell, because obviously you have this management group who now wants to buy this place. Well, y'all benefit from keeping these people in the dark. You benefit from not actively telling people you're
manner
a member. Yeah. I work for you. You're not our tenant. We're your management company.
Yeah.
You know, I think democracy's hard. Democracy's a lot
clearly
of work. It's got a lot of boring meetings. There aren't that many Babs or Earls Ivies in the world who are willing to serve on commissions and boards.
Way more complicated than anybody thought it would be.
My hat's off to you, Babs. I mean, you were on the police commission those years. You're on the board of all these. You got all these neighborhood meetings. Democracy can't happen without a lot of people willing to do that. And most of us don't want to.
And that's what you
were
saying about Civilian Review Board. And that's what I was saying about Board of Zoning. You have to have people. Like, the people who serve are just ordinary residents who have an interest and who get appointed to these commissions, and they give a lot of their time to trying to figure out weird, obscure zoning rules, and they have staff to help them.
Democracy
but
can't exist without an independent civic center. We can't have people do it for us.
Right.
I was just reading this thing about that, about the Trump administration in the Weekly Standard. The guy was saying, on the right and the left, we all thought the world was going to end with Donald Trump, and he wants to do a lot of terrible stuff, but we thought democracy was so fragile. What we didn't count on was this wonderful flowering of civic life. And even though this article didn't agree with the lawyers trying to stop the immigration ban, he said, isn't it great that they cared enough and they went to the airports and they did stop Trump? And that when it comes to every step he wants to make on immigration, they were going to fight on women's health. Now we're losing that one actually yesterday, but you know, in long term, the women's march.
But you have people like the Gates Foundation who's like, "Well, we'll do it. We'll provide it." Even though that's not a good model in the sense that we don't want like again, nonprofits and all, even with the ones that have lots of money, to do the things that we think government should do.
Yeah, but we need
them.
He was
to
arguing
do it.
That we were so asleep as a civic so and a very, civil society.
I wake up call.
That even though we don't want, as Marquise says, we don't want to look someone who wants to do bad stuff, but a blessing in disguise is
that
we
will get
up
off
our
butt and do something.
I think we are lazy. I think most people are lazy about their civic.
I want to be home at night.
About their civic
and
duties.
I don't want to think about my country bombing people and blowing other folk up. I don't want that.
I hate meetings.
Yeah.
And my circle of friends know that I hate meetings. I do.
We
I
do
hate
know.
Them. I hate them. But I have spent my life going to meetings because I knew that they were important, whether it was for my kids or for my neighbors. You just do what you have to
and
do.
You made the decisions that need to be run as a police commissioner, as an alder. You were on your own dime. I mean, technically, you get paid 7 cents as an alder, but I think it's per hour. But, you know,
but you're also putting
dime.
Yourself out there publicly to have to make decisions on behalf of constituents.
And then tell people talk to you. Like,
exactly. And people talk to you like you do this all the time or something. You're
I have a job.
And I have kids and a family, too.
Or, you know, you could just be a good citizen by listening to Pundit Friday and WNHH Radio. Broadcast
so shout out to everybody in public service right now.
Thanks
for what you do.
How about a shout out to the Board of Education for holding a meeting on the first night of Passover? Oh. Now, I think we can go overboard on saying you should have to close for a religious holiday. I mean, we Jews, for instance, we have so many holidays, it's ridiculous that even most Jews don't know these holidays exist. So, like, there are 13 days a year.
They just didn't want the New Haven independent there.
So, it's like 13 days.
That's really what it was.
As an observant Jew, I can't work 13 days a year, and I do not expect the government to shut down for those 13 days because I feel like most Jews don't follow it. But there are a few days a year in every religion. For instance, Good Friday, today when everything's closed.
Everything.
Easter and Christmas. And in the Jewish religion, Yom Kippur Rosh Hashanah, but more than anything, is the first night of Passover. Now, it's at night. Like, even though people like me don't work during the day, the first two and last 2 days, because I'm religious law, we're not supposed to, that's such a tiny fraction of the world in our country and our city that there's no reason to have to close things during the day. But they held a Board of Education meeting on the first night of Passover when two-thirds of all American Jews go to a Seder, including millions of Jews who are not religious. That's the one thing they do all year that is important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way they are going to be able to go to a Board of Education meeting. It didn't even occur to them. Like, the Board of Alders next week is even delaying a meeting on the seventh night of Passover, which is technically something that most Jews don't even know you're not supposed to work on. That's because they used to have observant Jews serving with Babs, a friend of mine named Ina, who got someone who taught them that. But the first night of Passover, and that to me might reflect that the Board of Ed doesn't really care of much connection to Jewish people.
I don't think they care about any people. Jewish or otherwise.
But like, I let them know. I said, you know, by the way, don't make this thinking about this, but it's the first night. It's the first night of Passover. So they knew. That's the first night of Passover. I mean, historically, you know, Jews were really big in the school system at one point, and there's still a lot of teachers, but I was
looking. Are they saying y'all withdrew your kids so we don't care anymore?
I don't know, but teachers, there are always so many Jewish teachers.
Yeah.
And at the Board of Ed, you don't see many Jews there, and certainly, you know, they're definitely Jewish individuals, none on the Board of Ed, but I think you're also saying we don't care if you're there, if you do this, because they did have the information. I'm actually stunned, because New Haven's a great place to be Jewish. They embrace us, just like we embrace Muslims and Christians, and, you know, for King's Day, they close school for Latino Christians. And I don't expect them to close for every Jewish holiday, but the one night of the year like that that's analogous to Good Friday or Christmas or Easter, I'm just shocked. And it was a big meeting. You know, they finally put the Boise Kimber plan to have an all-boys charter school.
Oh, so it's done?
It's done. But we couldn't report that. But, you know, it's like we weren't there. But I don't know. Am I wrong? Because I worry sometimes about being too caught up my own little world.
No.
I don't think they should close for all of our holidays.
No, because if people don't raise these things, then we will have a world that we won't even recognize. Somebody has to be the keeper of this kind of information and to continually get people to sort of remember that we have a responsibility to all our citizens to respect their beliefs. And it's not like this is some new religion and we're just like y'all some upstarts and, you know, it's like, oh, see us. No, I mean, we've done it it has been respected in the past. So why aren't we doing that? It's a leadership issue for me. You know, it really is a leadership issue.
Hey, you know where I saw some good leadership? City officials were responding to an issue first raised on this program and in the Independent last year about why is the police department rounding up street hookers? Now, people, you know, street hookers really do debase the quality of life in Fairhaven. A lot of drug traffic.
Oh, is there big street hookers in Fairhaven?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So I used to live there. And people now say to me, a lot of progressives say, we really don't want it here because we feel bad for the women, but it brings all sorts of crime and like drug stuff on my lawn, sex in public where my kids go. I used to find bullets on my lawn when I lived there. You know, it's like it was all drawn together. But what they did to attack it, they had a sting of the street hookers, which a lot of people felt like that just puts them in more trouble with the system. The police say, well, if we don't get them there, they're not going to try to seek drug treatment anyway, which is one argument. But they don't go after the Johns, which is more complicated for them to do, but they're driving the demand. So the Johns get away and the most vulnerable women don't. So there's protest about it. The cops hated the protest. They said, don't tell us how to do our jobs as though they're not part of government. But Mayor Tony Hart came on the radio and said, no, this is wrong. That's not our approach to policing. We do want people not to be, we do want to address the problem. That's a root problem in that neighborhood, but let's find other ways. So they found a program that started in Seattle that's been wildly successful. Liberals and conservatives both embrace it. The data has shown that there's a diversion program before they arrest the hookers the first time and low-level drug users. They get them in a plan that they have to agree to go to, where they say, you're going to be arrested unless you go through this program, where you work with everybody to get at the root of why you're doing this crime. Whether it's drug treatment you need, help with housing, training, mental health, whatever it needs. And it's similar somewhat to what they offer in Project Longevity. And they show that it's dramatically cut recidivism. So they're spending less money on criminal justice in those places. They have to arrest fewer people for committing the crime by offering enough people who want the help to go through this program first. The program is called LEAD, and L-E-A-D, it's an acronym. And law enforcement, I forget the rest of it. So Martha Okafor, the city's human services chief, took 11 people out to Seattle last week. Including two assistant police chiefs, Tony Reyes and Archie Generoso. And she took some community people who have been criminal justice reformers. She took some community foundation. They got some foundations to support what they're doing. And they watched the program. They loved it. And they said, we're bringing it back now. And we're going to apply money to try to do it citywide. But in the meantime, we want to pilot in the Hill and downtown and see if neighbors will go for it. So they're going to start community meetings telling people what they saw in Seattle. And I think that was government trying to find an answer and responding to an issue the public raised. I wish them success in doing it. I mean, any thoughts on this?
That's what we want government to do.
Yeah, I think it's great.
Right?
Cosign.
We want them to be innovative and, you know.
And what do we think about?
And diversionary. We want to keep people out of the system.
Yeah.
What do we think about? Or out of the systems that don't actually help them.
What do we think about neighborhood family restaurants that also have bars staying up until 1 or 2 in the morning on the weekends? Because there are two new places being planned that neighborhoods are very excited about. One is in Johnson Square, the old Humphreys. It's going to be the Lucy, the Green.
How many times? I'm
pizza.
So excited for that place. Yeah. And I don't know
this place.
It's right under.
I mean,
the
I know where it is. Yeah. It used to be
Humphreys.
It was Humphreys, but before it was Humphreys. After and it's it was
been,
Humphreys.
That's it. It's been a thousand things.
It actually goes back to at least the 1930s.
So
there was a boxer named Whitey Purek.
Hopefully get somebody.
And it was a neighborhood saloon, I believe, during Prohibition. I could be wrong. And it's always been this neighborhood anchor in that community. It was reborn in the 80s and 90s as a very popular restaurant and music place and stuff. And it's had a couple of iterations, some of which there was some crime associated with it. But it's right there in Johnson Square. This is a wonderful mini neighborhood that was cut off by the highway where State Street and East and Fairhaven.
Yeah.
And so Lucy wrote about how a very popular mobile pizza place that has parks next door is going to redo it, right? What are they going to do?
Yeah. So it's Doug Coffin, who runs Big Green Truck Pizza Big Green Truck Pizza. I always get the green and the truck confused. And his business partners, Robin Bodak, who's a chef, and Dom Giannotti. And they're opening a pizza restaurant that has a Mediterranean flavor. And they'll also have small plates and salads.
We need to get them to do some vegan pizza.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even though they're around the I was about to say, the Lanyards is up the street.
We have two places to go.
God forbid.
That's all right.
And they're also going to have a bar, but they're going to have a lot of... So it's kind of a bar and a front room for people who are over 21 who want to drink, and then a room for families and young adults who are under 21, and then a cool room for events. So... You want to have your bridal shower there, boom. You want
but
to have
and then
your...
like all the other restaurants in town.
It's a great... Well, it's
well they
great,
have that
it's
extra bonus space,
space,
which is really nice.
Yeah, the bonus space
meanwhile,
is
meanwhile, people want that, the neighborhood. And they also want the second neighborhood that just place, which in Westville. It's just like this place just needs some variances. All the public was for that, too. The old New Haven Savings Bank, Key Bank building at Fountain and Central. They want to make it sort of like what Delaney's was. Now, in both cases, they need permission to stay open late. In one case, 2 in the morning. In that case, 1 in the morning on the weekends.
And basically, that's to serve liquor.
So Markeisha went to a zoning meeting where something interesting happened, where the zoning members, the neighborhood was okay with it, right? But the zoning members, some people say, well, should these places be so late just to keep people up? So maybe it should only close at 11:30.
And also what's kind of driving that discussion is both of these locations are kind of pressed into residential like spaces.
But they're on the edge of residential.
They're on the edge, but like, for instance, the bank restaurant, there's a residence on one side.
That's true.
And there's a residence behind it. And in the case of the pizza restaurant,
there's two directions, a
high rise. And also the property that they used to, that previous tenants had leased for parking is zoned for residential. And the people who own that land, given that they're not, they were getting a parking variance as well. So exception. So they're like, we're not leasing that land anymore. So those people are like, well, we want to develop it into residential buildings. So that's going to affect our life.
So as Marquisa reported, she put these together in one article. That was great. Talk about this issue of sleep versus, Sleep versus money. So in both cases, neighbors pretty much for it. But the zoners in one case said, sure, let's do it. In the other case says, no, let's not. And their staff person, Tom Talbot, pointed out something very interesting to them, that if they were to make approach to say yes in one place and not another.
And what's interesting about that, our favorite vegan pizza providing restaurant, Delania's, is kind of a part of the story as well, because when they put in their bar, it created a big brouhaha on that strip of restaurants, because
State Street,
it was going to attract more people, and the competitors were like, you know, there's a parking issue. It's going to you have a bar for a certain amount, and you're like, you didn't get permission for that. So they went to court and everything. The court had actually ruled in their favor. In terms of, because what they went to court was about their ability to stay open past a certain time. The city said, you know, we can tell you that you can only stay open this amount of time. And so they've basically been doing that up and down State Street.
And they said, but you did a precedent. You have an uneven way of applying it. Mm-hmm. So what they told the zoners last week was, if you say yes in one case or another, that's uneven. It sets a precedent. And then you could be overturned by being shown to be inconsistent. So in the end, they both got permission. Mm-hmm. And in the end, we're going to continue having our communal life, that if we do go to these meetings that make us crazy, we can at least go afterwards pretty late to these nice restaurant bars, as the people do.
That makes and life try to better, talk, though,
that's
right?
Part of civic life,
right? You have
life,
a good
right?
place to go hang out and eat.
A place that you can even, like, as much as people worried about parking, people in Westville can walk.
Yeah. Sometimes
people on State Street can walk.
Where everybody and on Humphreys can walk.
That's nice.
I have to say, just as we end, as a pedestrian, I actually love when places are open late, because it makes me feel safer when I'm walking home.
I'm
you know,
Lucy.
That's a good point, Lucy. I like that point.
Darkened storefronts are places that people can jump out of. Right.
And I like when we can hang out on Friday to do Pundit Friday and talk about the news events. And this holiday day edition of Pundit Friday with the core crew salutes you and thanks you for listening today.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
And Passover. It's still Passover. Still
Happy Passover. Happy Good Friday. Happy Good Saturday. Happy Easter. Happy Easter Monday.
And thanks to the best pundits in the media universe, Babs Rolls, Ivy, Marquisa Ricks, and Lucy Gelman. And next week we'll be back with Harry Jost, Norma Rodriguez Reyes, and Joe Ugly. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it and fly free with us all weekend long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.